KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Ted Cruz wrapping the bacon around the semi-automatic weapon to cook it.
I understand that trade is not a sexy issue.
Nobody knows where the Republican Party is going to land. I mean, it's kind of like a country road. No one knows where it will end.
In many ways, Marco Rubio is the Michael Jordan of American politics.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. If you've seen films from Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas to Che to one of my favorite films, The Way of the Gun, to his newest film, Sicario, to a recent film I'd had a chance to talk to him about, Escobar, Paradise Lost, you look at Benicio del Toro. For me, and there's always something of the gothic in the performances. There's something of that sort of politeness veiling a sense of menace so often in the films. The Academy Award-winning actor is sitting across me. Benicio, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Elvis.
And there is, to me, a sense of the gothic in the
way. Yeah, what is that? What is gothic?
You know that sort of sense of like almost those old Universal like horror movies?
Oh, okay.
You know, where there's always that sort of sense of something being sort of kept, a secret being kept?
You mean like The Mummy?
Or The Wolfman.
Yes.
Yeah.
Hey,
yeah.
Those are my introduction to movies, where those horror movies, they used to come on Super 8. And my cousins were older, and they had a whole collection of Dracula, the Mummy, the Wolfman, the Creature from the Black Lagoon, the Son of Kong. And I used to see those movies as a kid, projected onto a wall, and they had no sound.
So you just heard the projector.
Yeah. And it was that's my introduction, perhaps, to movies. So who knows? Maybe you're right. I carry that in my subconscious. You know?
I don't even know. It's just because we've talked about this before. There's often this thing that you do where the characters don't say a whole lot and they don't raise their voices a lot, so people have to come to them a little bit. And I think about and all there's guys, as you know, the Wolfman in his civilian identity, or Dracula, all these people who never showed off how menacing they were, people had to learn it by spending time with them.
Right.
The idea of mystique, you know? I mean, we talked about that with your Escobar. He's this guy who doesn't raise his voice a lot. And that's something that you've done a few times in movies. I even think about in your Laszlo, in Fear and Loathing. I mean, he's a big guy with a kind of an intimate sense of talking to people.
You know, I was trained in theater. And theater, you have to project. And early on when I started doing TV or movies, my first couple of TV shows, I was big.
You're Miami Vice, you're really big in that.
I'm so big. screaming and just being heard. And I realized quick that for movies, it's stronger sometimes to be smaller and be intimate, because the circumstances requires you to be intimate if you're intimate in a scene. And so therefore, I think that being that small quality, or letting it come to me, it's dictated by the scenes, you know. But I think Fear and Loathing is at moments I'm big.
Oh no, you're quite
in more ways than one. But
no.
but I think.
But it's funny because I think that guy Laszlo taking up so much space, he's so big that you could make it smaller and it had more of an impact.
Right. And you can gauge it, and that way you create a rhythm, you know, a rhythm of like for the character, and then you know hopefully the editor, you know, gets it and works with that.
But it's also for me, and then maybe this is a part of the theater thing, although we were just talking before we got started, you got a chance to live some street theater of your own, walking the streets New York. Yeah. I mean, tell that. You walking through Midtown.
When I went to school, acting school in a Circle in the Square in New York, there was a summer I was going there, and I would finish class like around 11 o'clock or midnight, and that stretch from 51st and going through Times Square, I had to walk it every night, and it was very shady.
Around 51st, and you're on Broadway.
The whole thing, and I had to like cut right through it, and it was kind of shady, and in more ways than one. So I learned quickly, you know, like how am I gonna? Because I did it a couple times, and I started running, you know. But then I realized, you know, what I should do is I should take off my shirt and take off my gold chain and just put it in my pocket and just walk down, talking to myself like I'm crazy too, and I'll blend in. You know, I won't be like, you know, the goldfish in the alligator pond. So I was just, just becoming part of the scene. And so I would do, you know, Fred Fenster from 51st to all the way to 2nd Avenue, you know, from Times Square, you know, all the way to 2nd or 3rd, yeah.
That must have been a great place, though, or a great place to observe characters, because there's so much. You get so many different kinds of people walking through Times Square, tourists, cops, all kinds of people.
It still is. New York still is a great place to watch people. But Times Square was like, when you were watching people in Times Square, you were watching a Martin Scorsese movie in a way. You know, you were watching it. You were watching The French Connection. You were watching. You were watching many Billy Friedkin film. You were watching all those '70s films that we love in a way that take place in Manhattan or in New York. You know, you were watching. You could get ideas for character, and you know sometimes you know you go into class and you have to play something, and you just play something you saw, you know, some junkie or someone just like you know standing on the corner of 7th and 8th or whatever, and you know you could see something and then take it to class and use it, you know, and I do that with my work, you know.
I mean, one of the things I just loved about being in Times Square, and by the way, we're talking about New York in the past with our guest Benicio del Toro, whose new film is Sicario. One of the things I liked about being in Times Square at the time is anybody would talk to you. Anybody would talk to you. Now, and they might not make any sense, but anybody would talk to you. That must have been a really great experience,
even
wasn't it?
Yeah, even the people who were passed out would talk to you. That's for sure.
But it's funny because that thing that you probably either bring to your class, and in some way, some of your characters about this, a lot of people in some way wanted to be heard. I mean, people, if you're selling something, and so much of that was, I work here, or, hey, you want to come over here? I got this thing. You want to come over here? People wanting to make contact. And you
want a date? Want a date? Want a date? I mean, that was Times Square. I mean, it's nice that it's
clean
now, and people can walk around and not fear for like something being stolen or worse than that. But it was it's really hard to explain to younger people. That's to explain what Times Square was like, because it's almost unbelievable.
But you know what I'm talking about? That sense of when you would get home, you just felt like you actually lived through an adventure. Even though you look back, you go, somebody's just talking to me. But when you got home, your senses were so heightened. And that's something you can almost, I watch you do when you, especially you're playing a scene with somebody else, a way to sort of like get somebody else to react. That you have a real gift for that. Think about your stuff with Emily Blunt here when you're sort of in very terse terms explaining what your guy is. You're doing it in a way that you are going to be heard.
You know, I think actors have that. You know, I think that's one of the things that, especially, you know, I think actors that, when they start to go to acting school and they're training, I think there's that element of paying attention to life and looking at life and not being judgmental, because you might use it. You know, you might play a character you don't like. You might play a character that you would hate. So you have to keep yourself open. And I think all actors borrow from real life. You know, even things you don't like, you might have to just look at it and just keep kind of like a mental notepad of things, you know. I mean, I got things from, you know, when I was a kid that, you know, that I've thought, I have many things that I might have thought, oh, I got to use that in a movie, and I still haven't used it. you know.
Yeah.
And I've done, 30-some movies, you know. And so I still have things in my head. Oh, I could do that in a movie. And no, not this one. Not that one. Oh, okay, it's in the bank. Things that I saw or I experienced when I was younger, you know, even before I decided to be an actor. So, yeah, life is it's where you pull from.
But I don't know. I think to be an actor, to be any artist, you got to be hungry for that. You got to have this appetite for it. And the way you're talking about this and the way your eyes are lighting up as you're, like, reliving some of this stuff, you know, that 20 or walking past the hundreds
of... I work for a living.
Or walking past the hundreds of tats and knowing you, no matter how long you got, you weren't going to spend $2.99 for a steak at Tats. That you just knew not to do.
Tats Steaks. I used to go there. $5.99. You get a great piece of steak.
And on all the sides you could eat.
Yeah.
But hey, trust me. I
still think there's a couple out there.
Are there still Tats left?
I think so.
Okay. Making a note. I'm sure people, even as we speak, are Googling Tats.
I think there's one or two. I haven't stopped and eaten there, but that was a favorite of mine.
If you can find a $5.99 meal in Midtown Manhattan,
T-bone steak, you
better take it as soon as you can. But that thing that what you're talking about really is being hungry for for experience, and you pretty much had that at an early age, didn't you?
Yeah.
Because I know we talked before. You told me about what your family did, the kind of stuff they did, but it seemed like that kind of hunger you had was pushing you in a different direction that maybe you couldn't really articulate when you were younger, but it was always there.
Yeah, I think that, you know, you're born into your stage, into your play, and then I took a job that I interpret characters in stories, and so the foundation of that is really my experience as a kid in Puerto Rico. You know, growing up in Puerto Rico, I grew up around a time that it was really interesting because it was the early 70s when I start. You know, first of all, I lost my mom when I was very young, and that's a boom, you know. But to the minute I lost my mom, something happened that, you know, with my brother and I, that my brother hit the books and I hit the street. You know, it's like, I was going outside and going out, and because now I would come back from school, and I'd call my dad, say I'm home. Hang up the phone, I'm out. And Puerto Rico around that time had taken a lot of influence of a lot of Puerto Ricans that had gone to New York and they had come back. So there was a whole move of Puerto Ricans that have probably starts in the mid-60s.
Okay.
There was a big Puerto Rican migration into New York in the 50s and early 60s. And just around the mid-60s, a lot of Puerto Ricans start coming back and bringing different ideas and different, like, way of dressing, music. And all this was happening very close to where I lived. There was, you know, I lived in Santurce, and there was, like, I just remember, like, you know, there were many things that were kind of like New York, you know, like, and there was this boom of New York, the influence of New York and San Juan. And so there were, like, San Juan and Santurce had its mini Times Square.
Yeah.
You know, had its mini, you know, like, we're all shady people and all this stuff.
Did you like that part of town?
Yeah. I used to go around and hang out and, as a kid, and I knew that they knew me. You know, I was going around, going and hanging out with all kinds of people that, you know, that you might think, like, well, that's not a place for a 12-year-old or 11-year-old. But, you know, I would always come home because my dad was, like, the law, you know. So if I was in there at 6 o'clock, oh, boy. And it was old school, too, back then, you know. Like, that's another thing that has changed, you know.
Punishment,
like...
Let's take a break before the statute of limitations comes back. My guess is Benicio del Toro is the treatment this morning.
Oh. take KCRW with you on one of our mobile apps. Available for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry devices. Stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and our News 24 and Eclectic 24 streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. My guest, who I guess we're talking about everything, including his new role in the film Sicario, is Oscar winner Benicio del Toro. You were saying something before the break, and you talked about the music that came to Puerto Rico from New York. What was that? What was that that you were hearing that made you think? Because obviously you connected to that music.
Okay. The first concert I ever saw, I was 11 years old. I went to see Barry White.
No, you did.
That must have been 1970. I was 11, so 78,
yep.
79.
Yeah,
so
yeah, yeah, yeah,
Barry
yeah.
White came to San Juan. He played, and I had a friend whose sister was going, and I was invited, and I was sitting there, and I watched Barry White. But it was like, so Puerto Rico got this, you know, music. You know, there was salsa music, right? But there was the Fania All-Stars.
Yes.
Now, the Fania All-Stars, really, the bulk of it comes from
New York.
They're New York, either Dominicans, Cubans, Puerto Ricans, all together, and they make this amazing music. And so they were huge. That was the music, you know? So it was big. And basically what they did with salsa is basically what the Velvet Underground did with rock and roll. Or in jazz, free jazz. It just, every song was 12 minutes long, and a jam, and you could dance to it, you could just listen to it. So it was like a really interesting time to be in San Juan, and there was that clash of cultures, you know.
It must have given you this, again, I got to go to New York, I got to see what this is like.
I went to New York early on, as a kid, because there's always been a connection with Puerto Ricans in New York.
New York, you know, absolutely. So. But to live there, you must have felt like having all that stuff come to you, you want to be in that place, didn't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, it was, New York has always been amazing. But, you know, I always felt like in order to become an actor, you had to go to New York, and that's why I ended up in New York going to acting school. But then, you know, I couldn't hack it. I couldn't get a job and do the job thing. I wasn't going to college, and I just, like, couldn't do the job, the acting school. I was just, like, it was just...
What was it? Is it just you weren't getting work? Is that what it was?
It was really hard to, like, pay for my couch. I was living in a couch, you know, I had to pay $400 for a couch. I mean, for $400 in L.A., I could get an apartment. No kitchen. But I mean, like, you could really be a bit more comfortable in the West Coast, even though you needed a car. But besides that, it was and then I came to L.A. and I got a scholarship at the Stella Adler Conservatory. So I was able to breathe. So, you know, I got lucky. I got a scholarship, and I got a scholarship at the Stella Adler Conservatory. It wasn't just like I just landed. I had no idea where I was, you know. Then I realized that this was the mecca of acting, or interpretations, one of them, you know. So I studied with her, and
with her.
Yeah, she used to come to L.A. during. She had it figured out. She would be in New York during the spring and the fall, come to L.A. in the summer and the winter.
Okay.
And so yeah.
What was that like to actually be face to face with her in those classes? What were those classes like?
They were not classes per se. They were more like performances in a way, because she was 79, 80. And she had, there was a line of people that were not in the class that would pay to audit the classes. But the line went around the block. Everyone would come and listen to this woman to talk about plays and writing and acting. As an actor that you were in her class doing scenes, you would go up in front of an audience that had paid to come and watch her talk about these plays.
The classes were done in front of an audience?
There were maybe 15 students. And then the little theater, maybe, I don't know, it held maybe 90 people or the rest.
Probably an Equity Waiver House under 100.
Yeah, it's no longer there. It was on
Santa Monica Boulevard?
Argyle and Hollywood.
Okay, sure, yeah.
And that right now is a subway station there. So it used to be a little theater there.
Okay.
So it was really intense. I was the youngest in the class, and I was very cocky and very stupid. And so I got up, and I went up, and this is a funny story, because the rumor was this, that if you started a scene and she didn't stop you, she liked the scene. So the week before I went up for the first time, she saw a scene, it went to the end, and everybody clapped, and she liked it, and she talked about the play, and she talked about the actors, and it was great. And then she would stop almost every scene. Oh, you know, most of the scenes she would stop early on, bam, 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 and talk about the writing and have the actors then work on it. Well, here's my turn, and I go in, and I'm really pumped up, and, you know, I'm going to show Stella Adler who I am. And I'm halfway through the scene, and I'm telling myself, she's liking it. She's loving it. I'm three quarters into the scene. She's loving it. Yeah, and I'm going right through it. And I finish the scene, and the crowd, the paying crowd that came to out of the class, they stand up and they clap because it meant. And she just waved her hand and told everybody to sit down. And she turned to me and she goes, "Mr. Del Toro, do you like big parts?" I go, "I guess." And she goes, "Well, you ain't ready yet." Boom. Sit the huh down. Then she went to explain the character. I was doing a scene from Zoo Story.
Oh, what were you doing? What were you doing? Albie.
And it's at the zoo. It's at the park. And I'm telling the guy to get off the bench. And I'm playing the main guy.
Right.
Forgot his name. Jerry, maybe?
Yeah.
So she started asking me questions about the play. And I had no answer.
Really?
For like half of the stuff that she's telling me. And I realized, my God. But everything she said was right on.
Do you remember some of the stuff she said?
Everything.
Tell me, for example.
Well, she said, you know, for example, another scene, I remember this very clearly. I was doing another scene, and I was playing a junkie. And I remember I got down, I was sitting slouched on the couch. And before I even opened my mouth, she goes, "Sit back, put your shoulders back. You're a man. You're not a child. You ceased to be a child at the age of 7. You know? And it was like, wow. And then she goes, "A junkie uses his body to tell society that there is something wrong with society." And it was just like, it just opened all these doors of like how to think about, you know. But it's about interpretations, you know. That was the thing that I learned the most, that an actor tells a story.
It's the truth. My guest, who finally is ready for the big parts, is Benicio Del Toro. His latest big part is in the film Sicario.
Hey, Elvis, thanks a lot.
Yeah. Hey, you know, I think the world's caught up with you.
Yeah,
what, when she finally like gave you a prop, what was it for? Do you remember what it was, what you did?
Yeah, it was View from the Bridge.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that's a really hard piece to do.
Yeah. And, it was, she stopped me and she explained to me, she asked me what the character was trying to convey to the other character and to put in my own words and explain it to her. And I did. And I explained that what the character wanted to do. And then she said, "Well, do it again." After I explained it to her, that what I wanted from the scene. And then she said, "Well, now do it. Now that you explain it to me, do it." And when I did it, she said, "You know, that's it. That's what acting is, you know. It's just knowing what you want and how do you get it."
So when you got the script for Sicario and you started doing that, you know, figuring out who this guy was, what were some of the conclusions you came to about him?
What would make someone go that way? You know, what would make someone also from being from Mexico be part of the American machine, assisting the American machine into your own country, perhaps being a traitor, you know. what does, and then I start going through history and seeing samples of that. You know, there's been many moments that there's been people from other countries that join another country to assist another country to, for right or wrong, break the rules of their own country. So that was the first thing about Alejandro, is that element, because I do understand the Latin pride, the pride of being Mexican, the pride of Latin America. You know, people are proud of being from where they are. Like, I'm proud of being Puerto Rican. You know, there's a Cuban that will be proud of being Cuban. There's Puerto Rico is USA, but people from Venezuela are proud from being from Venezuela. You know, so that pride was number one. With the character I was playing, with Alejandro being Mexican, that's really important to, like, know. These are things that you can't play. You just have to understand them. There's no way of playing pride. There might be a way of playing pride by the way you dress. You keep your nails clean, you know, I don't know. but you're proud of what you are. But being proud of your own country is like, okay, you can't go around waving a flag. But these are things that you go into. So that was crucial for me. And could I believe it? You know, now, Edward Albee, and, you know, all due respect to Taylor Sheridan.
Taylor Sheridan wrote Sicario.
Yeah. This first script that is getting made, and he did a terrific job. But movie scripts, you know, they don't go through the process of plays that have been put on the stage, meaning a play
is workshop.
They work it in the rehearsals, and it evolves to the moment that it becomes a play. Then they do it, and then they publish it, and then years later you're doing it, and it's the play that has been
proven.
You know, proven, yeah. It's like the script of Sicario at the beginning, and the script of Sicario at the very end. It's a little different, just like a play would be, you know. So, you know, when you walk around New York and you see those, they're selling scripts. Those scripts are of the movie. They're not how they started, which is, you know, it'd be interesting to. I would love to read scripts how they started, you know, like Midnight Cowboy, you know, or how it started and how it, what it became, or Papillon, you know.
Oh, sure.
So going back to Taylor and the writing, so that was something that I needed to understand, and that was something that I had to believe, and I looked at history, and I know that it's believable that character, there could be a guy, you know, with that rage and that frustration, like Alejandro, whose family has been killed by bad guys in his own country, and I could believe this guy being part of a group of Americans. And being part of that group and using that group.
Well, that's what he's really doing.
The might of the U.S., you know, with drones and all kinds of stuff to get to what he considers as a problem in his own country. I believe that. So, you know, so that's basically, that was like something I think Stella-wise, you know. It's like you have to look at that character and go, okay, could you believe that guy? That's number one. And then, you know, you got to give him that dignity, and you got to be responsible with that character. You know, you got to be responsible. But it's all got to be from, you know, the fact that you could believe him either saying those lines or him doing what he does, you know, in the film.
And we're out of time. You got to come back. It's so good having you.
All right, man. Boy, we talked about Stella.
Yeah,
hey, not bad.
Not bad.
You didn't plan that one,
I didn't plan any of this. No, you're okay, kidding? My guest is Benicio Del Toro. His new film as actor is Sicario. A recording engineer who also mixes the show is Kat Yor. It's edited by Blake Veit, who's the associate producer. I'm going to go get some breakfast. It's The Treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
K KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.